reported. Your final comments on this?
Well, journalists must provide accurate, independent account of what's happening, including in time of crisis. We rely on them so that the misinformation that we see does not fuel the conflict. We rely on them so that we know the motivation and the implication of all the warring parties. And we rely on them to expose any potential for human rights violation or war crimes. So we call for the absolute resilience of journalists and the support of their editors so that they can do their job fairly without censorship.
Sharif Mansour, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Middle East and North Africa Program Coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists. That does it for our show. A happy birthday to Juan Gonzalez and Miguel Noguera. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operation and programming of KABU in accordance with the requirements of the Communication Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kabu.fm. The Policy and Governance Committee meets on the third Tuesday of March, June, September, and December at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kabu.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Due to technical problems, the Old Mill Variety Hour Indigenous Peoples Day special did not air on Monday, October 9. Instead, we will be airing the program next Monday, October 16 at 9 a.m. Join the Moles to hear stories, poetry, and commentary on efforts to decolonize and reclaim Indigenous ways of being. Music by Fawn Wood.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. A big thank you to our recent donors, Evan G., Christopher B., Abby H., and Carol N. Become like these lovely people and support KABU during our fall membership drive by going online to kabu.fm/give. Now, your KABU Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the Fall Membership Drive edition, the KABU Evening News, advocates call on Governor Kotek to close the Coffee Creek Women's Prison.
The Secretary of State won't pull the audit her office did of the OLCC.
And the Oregon joins 16 other states in the FTC in an antitrust lawsuit against Amazon.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Monday, October 16th, 2023. KABU is currently in our fall membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Reed Johnson.
And I'm Ron Bronson. Advocacy group, the Oregon Justice Resource Center, called on Governor Tina Kotek to close the state's only women's prison, Coffee Creek Correctional Facility. This comes after a state-ordered report found that there were retaliatory atmosphere, lack of mental health staffing, and a disproportionate number of suicide attempts compared to men's prisons. Both inmates and staff voiced concerns about reporting sexual abuse and other wrongdoing. Governor Kotek started an advisory panel to make long-term recommendations, but the public hasn't been allowed in either of those two meetings so far. Oregon Justice Resource Center says more drastic action is needed. In their analysis of the state's report, quote, "Women should not be incarcerated," end quote, at Coffee Creek. Executive Director Babin Singh told the Capital Chronicle, quote, "Really, what they're saying is, this is inhumane. This is not fit for humans," end quote. The advocates say in the report that the Department of Corrections itself is in need of an overhaul in light of the abuse of incarcerated women at Coffee Creek. They're pushing the state to create smaller regional prisons throughout the state so that women can be closer to their families and communities. Coffee Creek houses more than 800 inmates. They also recommend capping the number of inmates based on the staffing levels at the Department of Corrections.
Oregon Secretary of State LaVon Griffin-Fillade says she's personally personally audit the audit of the Oregon Liquor and Cannabis Commission that was published earlier this year. Some of its conclusions have been called into question because it was caught up in the scandal that ended the tenure of former Secretary of State Shemaiah Fagan. Fagan took a consulting contract with a prominent and controversial weed shop, LaModa. That's all while overseeing an audit of the exact regulatory agency that controlled her employer's business. In response, the Oregon Department of Justice released a report from an independent investigator that recommended pulling down the audit of the OLCC entirely. It comes down to a question of whether the audit was truly independent. Griffin-Fillade said, quote, "I will personally oversee a reevaluation of the evidence presented in the OLCC audit. With 16 years experience as a government auditor, I am well equipped to ensure that every action is taken to restore the public trust in this report," end quote. The DOJ didn't solely blame the audit on Fagan. They also faulted state auditors, those still in their jobs today. Some speculate that Griffin-Fillade might get some blowback from Kotek, who ordered the independent review, and State Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum, who oversaw it.
A landmark lawsuit from the Federal Trade Commission aims to break up the online retail giant Amazon. Oregon and 16 other states have joined the suit. Eric Tegedoff has the details.
Oregon is one of 17 states that has joined the Federal Trade Commission in its lawsuit to break up the online retail giant Amazon. The FTC has brought an antitrust suit against the marketplace behemoth, charging the company with illegally maintaining a monopoly. Ron Knox with the Institute for Local Self-Reliance says half of online sales happen through Amazon's website, meaning small businesses have to play by Amazon's rules if they want to reach potential customers.
What Amazon is accused of doing is essentially abusing and ripping off those small businesses, those third-party sellers, that have to be on Amazon.com in order to reach the customers. And it does that through these ever-increasing and often exorbitant fees that it charges.
Knox says Amazon also stipulates that third-party sellers can't sell their products for less than what they sell on Amazon's website. That leads many people to buy through Amazon, especially if they have free shipping through its Amazon Prime membership. The company counters that if the lawsuit succeeds, it would actually hurt customers by leading to increased prices and slower shipping. Knox says the FTC is using a straightforward application of antitrust laws in this suit.
It says you can't have a monopoly and use illegal and illicit tactics to maintain or grow that monopoly power. You have to let other people compete. And what the FTC is saying is that Amazon, through its actions, is not doing that.
Knox believes if courts rule in favor of the FTC and the 17 states that have joined the lawsuit, consumers will see the difference.
When they see the lower prices, when they see new marketplaces entering, when they have different and innovative ways to ship their goods, get goods shipped to their house, and the small businesses can respond to that need, I think it's going to make for a better marketplace.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff. This story was produced with original reporting from Sonali Kulhetkar for Yes Media.
On Friday, hundreds gathered in downtown Portland to rally in support of Palestinians. This comes amidst Israeli airstrikes that have killed over 2,700 and left nearly 10,000 wounded in Gaza. Israel's airstrikes follow an October 7th surprise assault by Hamas in southern Israel that killed 1,400 Israelis. Demonstrators waved Palestinian flags and bore signs reading, "Cease fire, negotiate peace, let Gaza live," and "When people are occupied, resistance is justified." Among demonstrators was Saraya Abuelhawa, excuse me. She told Coin News 6, quote, "When you say you stand with Palestine, you're even standing with the innocent Jewish people that have lost their lives. This has been going on for so long. When is it going to end?" End quote. In the United States, pro-Palestine rallies have been faced with police crackdowns and arrests. In France, the Interior Minister announced a ban on pro-Palestinian rallies in the name of quote-unquote public order. The United States and other Western countries have decried the attack by Hamas on Israeli civilians as an act of terrorism and stated their unequivocal support of Israel in its retaliation. Israeli airstrikes have been strongly condemned by UN independent experts for indiscriminately targeting civilians and civilian infrastructure. Israeli leaders like President Isaac Herzog have argued for collective punishment for Palestinian Gazans for the actions of Hamas. Gazans themselves have called this week's events a second Nakba. They evoke the name given to the forced expulsion of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians from their homes in southern Israel into what is now Gaza in 1948.
Republicans struggle to choose a Speaker of the House. No excuse absentee voting flourishes in Maine. And a Kentucky law takes aim at homeless encampments. With more on the story, it's Edwin Javira with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
House Republicans have selected as their nominee to be the Speaker of the People's House, the chairman of the Chaos Caucus, a defender in a dangerous way of dysfunction, and an extremist extraordinaire.
Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries opposes Republican Judiciary Committee Chairman Jim Jordan's bid to become Speaker of the House. Another vote is expected early this week, but may not bring clarity. The lack of Republican unity is frustrating many. Florida Representative Kat Kamick echoes others in her party who say it's threatening their narrow majority. She calls what's happening reality TV focused on angertainment.
It is this notion that you rage against the machine. You stomp your feet. You tweet in all caps, but you actually don't fix anything. It's the perception of fighting. It is a show.
Meanwhile, a new study finds most states need to improve their redistricting processes. The Common Cause Report says drawing district lines can be secretive and leave out communities of color. Co-author Dan Vicuña says some states are engaging the public more, but it's not always enough, and regular citizens are aware and frustrated.
The public understands that whether you're kept in one district with a community that shares concerns of all sorts can really make the difference between having a champion in the halls of power or not having a champion.
With less than a month before another election day, the process is already underway. 27 states in Washington, D.C. offer no excuse absentee voting, and the number using it rose sharply last year. In Maine, more than 30,000 voters have already requested a ballot. Maine's Secretary of State Shayna Bellows says people should have options on how to vote.
When we maximize the opportunity for people to vote, we increase the number of people who actually participate. And the more people that participate in our democracy, the stronger our democracy is.
Half of state attorneys general are asking the Supreme Court to overturn a Fifth Circuit ruling upholding restrictions on medication abortion. The ruling reversed an FDA decision allowing the abortion drug mifepristone to be taken later in pregnancy, mailed directly to patients, and prescribed by mid-level providers. A new law in Kentucky has housing advocates worried about people who are homeless. The Safer Kentucky Act, expected at the next legislature, proposes a statewide camping ban with penalties of up to $5,000 and a month in jail. Tish Shoup, Clark County's Community Services Housing Director, says jailing them won't help, especially if they have mental health or addiction problems.
Having a policeman come up to them and then just throw them in the back of the car and handcuffs and throw them in jail, well, that's only going to make that issue worse. So if they've been working with anybody and they've actually made some progress, well, that just sets them back.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
A pilot zero fares bus program has proven so popular in Albuquerque that the push is on to make it permanent. Roz Brown has more in New Mexico.
Free buses may soon become a basic service in Albuquerque. A vote to make a pilot zero fares rider program permanent is set to come before the city council. Councillor Tammy Feibelkorn says the program has had benefits for all transit riders, but especially transit-dependent riders, youth, seniors, essential workers, families, and people with disabilities. She notes its positive financial impacts and also its practicality.
It's faster. The stops can be faster because you just get on. The bus drivers are safer. There's not that forced interaction with folks over fares or passes or show your ID or any of those things.
Initially, the pilot program was meant to last a year, but after several extensions, the program would become permanent with majority vote from City Council. Feibelkorn says a recent analysis showed that prior to free fares, one nonprofit was spending more than 30% of its annual budget to provide bus fares to its clients. Issa Burks has been using the bus to get back and forth to work and says the free fares help him keep more of his paycheck.
It's a lot easier, lots less stressful. I got to worry about the monthly bus passes and all that. Made it a little easier for me to get back and forth, get to work and stuff.
The city estimates that 75% of bus riders have an annual income of less than $25,000. In addition to offering a work solution, Fibocorn says if you don't have a vehicle, you can still get to parks and participate in many of the fun things Albuquerque offers.
There was a young man that lives in the South Valley that had never gone to the mountains and gone hiking until free fares. And that is shocking and sad, but I'm so glad that we're able to provide that opportunity to him now.
She says the pilot program was originally supported with help from a federal grant. If approved by City Council, future costs, estimated at $3 to $4 million per year, would become part of the city's $1.4 billion annual budget. This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
You are listening to a fall membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $55,000 by the end of October. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for a special rebroadcast of our interview with Tara Hurst, the Executive Director of the Health Justice Recovery Alliance. At 6 p.m. is Labor Radio. At 6:30 is Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, LITR, Let's Talk About Race. Tonight's weather will be cloudy, with rain showers stopping before sunset. The overnight low will be 53 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy, with a high of 65. Today in history, in 1997, Japanese tennis star Naomi Osaka was born. She's been ranked number one in the world and is the first Asian player to hold the top rank in singles. The quote of the day is from American professor Noam Chomsky, who said, quote, "The most effective way to restrict democracy is to transfer decision-making from the public arena to the unaccountable institutions, kings and princes, princely castes, military juntas, party dictatorships, and modern corporations."
A U.S. district court grants a motion to the Alaska Federation of Natives in the latest case challenging native hunting and fishing rights. With that story and more, it's Jill Freitas with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Jill Freitas from KMBA in Anchorage, Alaska, filling in for Antonia Gonzalez. Last week, the U.S. District Court for the District of Alaska granted the Alaska Federation of Natives motion to intervene in U.S. versus Alaska, the latest case challenging Katie John. AFN President Julie Kitka said, quote, "This is a welcomed ruling. AFN has a special place in this litigation dating all the way back to the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act and Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act and culminating most recently in Sturgeon. We'll defend the legal rights of Alaska Natives to engage in subsistence hunting and fishing anytime our ways of life are threatened," end quote. According to AFN, U.S. versus Alaska began in 2021 when the state of Alaska refused to honor U.S. Fish and Wildlife subsistence management decisions on the Kuskokwim River. AFN goes on to say it increased rapidly in 2022 when the state again refused to abide by federal closures regarding salmon fishing along certain parts of the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. In a statement, AFN co-chair Anna Hoffman said, quote, "This federal protection for rural Alaskans, secured by Alaska Native leaders decades ago, is the source of our nourishment physically, emotionally, culturally, and spiritually. This is our way of life. It is our existence," end quote. AFN predicts that U.S. versus Alaska will make its way to the U.S. Supreme Court. Last week, you heard about the Pyramid Lake Paiute tribe's efforts to recover an endangered fish by modifying a 100-year-old diversion dam. The Mountain West News Bureau's Caleb Bradle has more on why the tribe's fish passage project is more urgent than ever.
Shiva Sundaresan is deputy director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and attended the project's groundbreaking. He says dams aren't the only obstacles fish populations like kwiwi and Lahontan cutthroat trout have to overcome.
As climate changes in places, we're seeing changes in snowpack, changes in the timing of when you have snow melt, changing water temperatures. All of that is definitely affecting fish populations, fish habitat.
He says that's why the Fish Passage Project at Numana Dam is one of dozens nationwide receiving federal funding.
The more I think we can restore these ecosystems, allow fish to migrate up and down the streams, have habitat where they can find refuge when, you know, water temperatures rise, the better we will be at protecting and restoring, conserving these fish populations.
At the Pyramid Lake Paiute Reservation, the underwater ramp will allow up to 600,000 kwiwi to swim over the diversion dam to new spawning grounds. Lisa Hakey is a Reno-based project leader with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Historically, they move in large numbers at the same time, and they back up behind this current design. Now, with this gradient structure downstream, it's designed specifically for kiwi swimming capacity and speed.
She says when river flows go down this fall, construction of the ramp will speed up. The tribe is putting the project out for a construction bid, and a third-party contractor will build it. Tribal Chairman Phoenix says the Pyramid Lake Paiute Tribe is excited to finally see shovels break ground on a decades-long effort to recover their native fish.
It's historical, it's big for us, and it's part of our existence. You know, it signifies us as Numu people here at the Pyramid Lake Paiute Tribe.
He adds he's looking forward to the day when the kiwi population is big enough for tribal members to catch, fillet, and eat them once again. For National Native News, I'm Caleb Radel.
I'm Jill Freitas.
A new report rates every state on how it handled redistricting and found Oregon's process is lacking in some key areas, including getting public input. State legislators draw voting lines using census data, which leaves the process open to politics. Eric Tegedoff reports.
Oregon has room to improve when it comes to drawing voting district lines, according to a new report. The nonpartisan elections watchdog Common Cause gives the state a grade of C- for its redistricting process, which happens when states receive census data and use it to map the borders of legislative districts. Head of Common Cause Oregon, Kate Titus, says Oregon is a model of democracy's best practices in many respects and consistently has high voter participation.
But when it comes to redistricting, Oregon has a process that's controlled by the legislature. And that's inherently problematic because legislators have a conflict of interest in drawing the lines of the districts that they're going to run in.
The report criticizes Oregon for inadequate public outreach and failing to incorporate public input, especially from Confederated Tribe of Warm Springs members over their concerns that the map split their reservation from the nearby city of Madras. Dan Vicuña is the director of redistricting and representation for Common Cause. He says in past decades, redistricting was a relatively unknown and unscrutinized process. However, Vicuña believes the public is increasingly connecting the shape of voting maps to their fight for resources.
The public understands that whether you're kept in one district with a community that shares concerns of all sorts can really make the difference between having a champion in the halls of power or not having a champion.
Vicuña says the states that fared best in the report are the ones that took redistricting out of the hands of legislators in favor of independent bipartisan commissions. California and Massachusetts scored the highest grades, A-. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Young people aged 18 to 34 voted in record numbers in the 2020 presidential election. A new study finds states that automatically mailed ballots to all registered voters that year had the highest youth voter turnout rate. That's led voting rights advocates to push for vote-at-home laws nationwide. Catherine Carley has more in the story in Massachusetts.
States that automatically mailed ballots to all eligible voters had significantly higher youth voter turnout rates in 2020, according to a new study. Voters aged 18 to 34 voted in record numbers that year, but six of the top 10 states for youth voter turnout were so-called vote-at-home states. Barbara Smith-Warner with the National Vote-at-Home Institute says younger people have become accustomed to home delivery for most things.
The ballot comes to you. You have a couple of weeks to spend time on making that voting decision, and then you have a variety of ways to return it.
More than 50% of young Massachusetts voters participated in the 2020 election. Warner says democracy wins when these young people are engaged, and that the success of vote-at-home laws should lead to an expansion in more states. In Massachusetts, any eligible voter can vote by mail, but must first fill out an application to do so. Vote-at-home advocates say that's just another barrier to getting a ballot in voters' hands. Warner says online tracking of ballots also prevents voter fraud and enables the state to alert voters of any ballot irregularities with signatures or dates.
Whereas those ballots come in, if there's any problems with them, those voters are notified about that and given the opportunity to cure whatever is wrong with their ballot.
Warner says people can always return their ballot to their polling station on election day, but that vote-at-home policies help shorten voting lines and reduce the burden on election workers. For Commonwealth News Service, I'm Catherine Carley.
The annual economic value of water and freshwater ecosystems is estimated to be $58 trillion. That's equivalent to 60% of the global gross domestic product. But in the world's freshwater ecosystems are in a downward spiral, according to the World Wildlife Fund's new report, The High Cost of Cheap Water. Eric Alatas has the story in Colorado.
The world's water and freshwater ecosystems, with an annual estimated economic value of $58 trillion, are in a downward spiral, according to a new World Wildlife Fund report. Michelle Thieme with the fund says freshwater systems are the planet's life support system, and they provide tremendous value for people in Colorado and across the globe.
Everything from drinking water to water that is used to grow the food we eat and the fibers that make up the clothes we wear. They're also critical for wildlife and fisheries and for their survival.
Rivers, lakes, wetlands, and groundwater aquifers have been severely degraded from overuse, pollution, and drought. One-third of the planet's remaining wetlands have been lost to human development since 1970, and freshwater wildlife populations have dropped by 83%. Growing numbers of people, including 40 million Americans that depend on the Colorado River, face water shortages and food insecurity. Thieme says it's important to remember that water doesn't come from a tap. It comes from nature, and access to water depends on healthy freshwater ecosystems. As the planet continues to warm, Thieme warns there is an urgent need to accelerate and expand management efforts to mitigate the impacts of climate change and adapt to the new reality.
Everything from reducing irrigation losses, changing municipal water demand, maintaining minimum flows. There are a whole host of options, but the time is now to really invest in those types of actions.
Thieme says federal and local governments have a role to play in water management, regulation, and investments in degraded systems. Corporations and other businesses need to ensure that their water use and pollution are within sustainable limits. Ordinary people can pitch in as well.
Small actions like planting natives on their own lands, installing water-efficient plumbing in their households, and supporting policies or community leaders that advocate for sustainable water management.
This is Eric Galatis for the Colorado News Connection.
Pacific Island nations stand to lose much more than land as sea levels rise due to climate change. The Rising Nations Initiative seeks to secure a permanent existence for threatened island countries, protecting their sovereignty and culture. Anthony Liowitz, Dr. Anthony Liowitz, has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Liowitz, and this is Climate Connections. As seas rise, some small, low-lying Pacific islands are disappearing, inch by inch, into the ocean. Experts warn that countries such as Tuvalu and the Marshall Islands could become uninhabitable this century. Kamala Makran of the UN Global Center for Climate Mobility says the threat to these nations goes beyond land loss.
It's their statehood and sovereignty being challenged. It's their heritage and culture being challenged.
Makran leads the Rising Nations Initiative, which aims to protect the sovereignty of island countries threatened by sea level rise. He says the world must guarantee these nations a permanent existence, even as their homeland disappears underwater. For example, he says it will be important to preserve countries' legal rights to the same ocean resources. Government services could be digitized to decrease reliance on physical buildings, so citizens could access them from anywhere. And he says steps must be taken to build a record and repository of their culture and heritage.
In order to be sure that it's something that continues to be cherished, continues to be shared, and continue to be celebrated.
He says there's no time to waste to protect and preserve these vulnerable nations in a warming world.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to a fall membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Monday, October 16th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes myself. The producer and engineer is Althea Billings. Special thanks to Eric Tagadoff, Jill Freitas, Edwin J. Vieira, Catherine Carley, Eric Galatis, Roz Brown, and KBOO's favorite Dr. Anthony Liowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. And a special happy 30th birthday to my dear sister, Julianne. I love you and I'm so proud of you. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Reed Johnson.
And I'm Ron Bronson. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. KBOO is currently in our membership fall drive, our fall membership drive, of course. So now is a great time to join. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to our website at kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm here with Tara Hurst, the Executive Director of the Health Justice Recovery Alliance. Welcome to the show, Tara.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time to speak with us today. To start out here, can you tell me a little bit about your organization?
Sure. So the Health Justice Recovery Alliance has been working to ensure that the implementation of Ballot Measure 110 was done as the voters intended. And for us, that really means making sure that we are moving addiction from a criminal justice response to a healthcare response, and also really making sure that, you know, we know that communities of color have been, and especially Black, Latino, Indigenous, Tribal, and Native communities specifically, have been over-incarcerated and under-treated. And so making sure that the services that are being stood up are really focused on culturally and linguistically specific care, and ensuring that we are getting the right services into the community that are really going to help people get onto the road to recovery.
State lawmakers announced the creation of a joint interim committee on addiction and community safety response. From your perspective, where does that fit into addressing the